Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Joining us today is an author. Her book is From Daylight to Madness, The Hotel Number One. And it's Jennifer Ann Gordon. Thank you for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me, Alan.
So, Jennifer, where did it all start for you, other than your parents? Like, did you, like, like, how did you decide to actually write a book?
That's a good question. So, I've always been kind of a scribbler. I've always, you know, in high school, I journaled. After that, I wrote poetry for years. And I always, like, had it in the back of my head that I wanted to write novels. But every time I sat down to try to write a novel, I would talk myself out of it. I would just, you know, say, oh, I can't do it. It's just, like, too massive.
What else? Did you not have confidence?
I didn't have confidence, you know, and I think a lot of writers we're artists, so we're insecure, and I felt like I didn't have the confidence enough that it would be good. I didn't have the confidence that I would be able to finish it, but then I finally did. I mean, when I sat down to write my first book, which came out last year, called Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent, I just started it kind of as an exercise. I thought maybe it'll be a short story or maybe it'll be a novella. And the characters just kind of got a life of their own, and a novel came out of it. Hmm. And I think that's even the book From Daylight to Madness. When I sat down, I thought the same thing. I said, I have this story that I've been planning for years. I don't know if it's going to be a novel. Maybe it'll be something shorter. And I think that takes some of the pressure off. And then From Daylight to Madness turned into, like, this massive work, which is why it's now broken into two books instead of just one very long one. That's why it's The Hotel Number One.
Do you feel like you've gained confidence now? Like, are you at the point where you think, okay, I'm a writer?
Yes, but I think, again, as an artistic personality, there's always going to be that little lingering question mark in the back of your head of, I think I'm a writer. Do other people think I'm a writer? Like, I like my book. I'm writing a book that I would want to read. will other people want to read it? And I go back and forth, like, while I'm writing, thinking things like, you know, this is brilliant. I'm a genius. I'm going to win the Bram Stoker Award. And then the very next paragraph, I'm just like, how do I make a sentence? Does this even make sense?
Yeah. So I guess so when you get to that point, you feel like you're constantly growing then. Like each book will get better that you do.
I think so. I really do. I mean, and I've had people who read my first novel who have now read From Daylight to Madness, and they can already see the difference. And it's From Daylight to Madness, it's just my second novel. And my editor, who's working on the edits for The Hotel Part 2, she sees a difference even from Daylight to Madness, which is, they were all kind of written at the same time, but like she can see, you know, stylistic differences and like a clearer narrative voice.
Yeah.
Well, less mistakes.
That's
maybe,
pretty,
hopefully.
That's that's natural. That's natural. I've been through, I think I'm on book 16, and I think each book gets a little better because you get better at being able to express what you want to.
Right.
And so that's, yeah.
Yeah, and just like developing your voice, like your my voice as an author, your voice as an author. Like it's interesting now, like just having, you know, kind of finished my third book, having people say to me like, oh, I love the style that you write in. And I love that it's so lyrical. I love the poetry. I love the rhythm of your words. And it's interesting to me that other people can see that. I'm like, oh, I have a style. And, oh, you got it.
Yeah. Well, you know, but I think it's really hard for any of us to recognize our own style. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's from outside in. So how does that affect you if someone gives you not a good review or someone doesn't like your stuff?
Oh, you know, I'll be honest, I hate to say when I first started, because I'm still such a baby at all of this, but when my first book came out, I got a lot of good reviews, and then I got a really bad review, and I cried. I cried myself to sleep. I felt like it was the end of the world, and I talked to my other writer friends, and one of them said, I want you to go to Amazon and look up your favorite books and read their bad reviews. So I did. You know, I went to Amazon, I looked up Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson, and I read all the one-star reviews. Not all of them, but a bunch of them.
Yeah.
And people who, those reviews were saying things like, you know, oh, it was boring, it was confusing, this wasn't real horror, like, I hated her style, too overly descriptive. And it was all the things that I love about her books, people were saying they hated. So that made me feel better.
Oh, good.
Because, you know, my first bad review, I remember it said something like, you know, it's sad, depressing, slow, nothing happens, but the end did tie it all together. And I thought, well, at least that person read it all the way to the end. So that was a positive to take out of it. And since then I've gotten, you know, my fair share of not so great reviews. I mean, most of them are still very, very positive, and I think the people who don't like the style of my writing, like it is very lyrical. There's a lot of like poetry infused in the language, and it's not for everybody. And no matter how good my book is, if somebody doesn't want to read a gothic horror novel that is lyrical and poetic in nature, they're not going to like my book. Like if they just won't, you know, they're not going to like it if they don't want to read something that's kind of sad.
Right.
Because I've gotten reviews like that too. They were like, oh, it was just depressing. I'm like, but I'm like, didn't you read the back of the book? I mean, it clearly is about like a woman who goes to a mental institution after she loses a baby. Of course, it's a little depressing.
Kind of sounds like a party.
I know. Well, I remember even way back when I was pitching my first book, I got an offer from a publishing house that I didn't take, but they said, we loved it. We loved everything about it. We want to publish it, except it needs a rewrite because your main character should be funnier. He should be funny. And in that book, Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent, it's about a man who's slowly going insane because he feels responsible for the death of his son and his wife. And I'm like, but he's not a funny character. Like, he's not going to be cracking jokes. He's having a nervous breakdown in a haunted house. And so I asked them, I was like, what parts am I supposed to like make funny? And they were like, well, just like give them a sense of humor, make them maybe like sarcastic. And I said no, because then it wouldn't be my book anymore. And he wouldn't be my character that I loved so much.
Yeah. Well, and that's something you have to be careful of, because not only that, there's, one of my books was made into made for TV movie. And I didn't realize, I was so excited that they wanted to sign me that I signed and flew down to LA and had a great time. And at the end of the day, they changed the whole thing. And I got really kind of out of joint. You know, I kind of thought, well, yeah, this isn't even close to the book. It's like, no, but we got to keep people on the edge of their seats. We want to make sure they don't turn the channel. It's like, oh, okay, so then why don't you just write your own story? I mean, it was...
But, maybe they really liked your title.
Well, it was the title, it was who it was about, and it gave them credibility. So that's kind of what they do. So yeah. if you've got like a true crime book and it's credible, and if it's part of what they're doing, and then all of a sudden it gives you that credibility, so people say, well, this has got to be pretty real.
Yeah,
some of it is, but there's a lot that they just sort of throw in there. And so you have to be very careful with that and with publishers, because they will do things like that. But anyway, now when we get into your characters, how is it that you decide your characters? Like, where do they come from? Is this total imagination? Is this something that you've met someone and you know them, or you've seen them on the street? Where does it start?
So for me, now this is probably going to sound like I'm a kook. But I'm just gonna go with it. From Daylight to Madness, I'll talk about the characters in that book, because that is my new release. My two main characters, and again, this sounds weird, came to me because I was getting past life regression. I was being hypnotized, and I saw flashes very specifically of my main character, Isabel, flashes of her life and some of the experiences she had and a person she met. And I became so fascinated whether this was my past life, if it was just my brain telling me a story. I wanted to know more about her. Isabel. And so I created a story for her, but she came to me in under hypnosis, which sounds silly.
So where does that come from? No, that's, you know, we've got a medium that hosts our paranormal show. So I'm quite familiar with this. So do you have, I guess, how do I say it? Do you have a belief or an interest, or have you had experiences in the paranormal that makes this come to life for you?
Yes, to all of those things. I am a believer in the paranormal. I'm a believer in ghosts. I'm a believer in past lives. And I'm a believer that places can hold the energy of things that may have happened there, or people that may have lived there. And I've had a lot of experiences with spirits. I've gone to a lot of haunted places, and I do feel them when they're about. And
but that's interesting. So when you have a character like I believe it was Isabel, right?
Yes.
And Isabel comes to you when you're doing one of these past life, or when you're doing kind of a hypnosis or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happens, and you decide that you're going to write a book using her as a character, did that put a sense of responsibility on how you wrote it?
Yes, it did, especially because, you know, the experiences I had during the past life regression, I felt so connected to her because obviously it was past life regression, so she's part of me. And even though this book is fiction, the very, very first scene, my prologue, is what I experienced in the past life regression. So that sort of came to me fully formed. I just had to write it. I had to make it art instead of a memory. So she came to me like that, and then I created a world around her. I took that experience that I believe she had, and that was the catalyst for, you know, a horror novel, as it turns out. You know, when I had the past life regression, it was years and years and years ago, and I always thought I'm going to write her story, and I thought I was going to write historical fiction, and I think that was one of the reasons why I didn't write that book for so long, because I kept thinking, no, it's going to just be literature. It's just going to be the story of this woman's life. And once I realized that I could do both, I could have it be historical fiction, and I could have it be, a creepy, gothic, haunting, then that made me feel better. So I had a responsibility to her, but also the imagination to, create a world for her that wasn't real.
So do you still feel a connection to Isabel? And have you had experiences since then?
I have. I do feel very connected to her. She was really, really real to me. All my characters are very real in my head. And sometimes they do things that I don't expect them to do, and then I yell at them. But I am connected to her. But I'm also really connected to my completely fictional characters, too. I think, as a writer, I spend a lot of time building the character, even just in my head. I know everything about them. I went to school for theater, so one of the major things that we would always work on is character development. We would, fill whole notebooks about a character that we were playing. Even if none of that made it to the stage, we had to know them. We had to know everything about them. So I feel like I do that with the characters I write.
Well, where do those supporting characters come from for you? Again, back to the earlier question. So, because Isabel came to you in an experience, but with the other characters, the supporting characters in the book, how did you create them? Are you that person that sits in the coffee shop and watches people and pick things up?
I'm not. I'm really not. I used to, again, like in school for theater, that would be some of our assignments, is go and watch people. But now, I don't know, I think they just kind of pop out of my head. But they're also, I won't lie, some of them are like amalgamations of people I know.
Right.
You know, like a little bit of, you know, the ex-husband mixed with, a bad ex-boss, you know, like something crazy, and then voila, villain.
Yeah. Yeah, but you, so do you take people that you've kind of known? Let's say you take an ex-boss and an ex-boyfriend or husband or whatever, and they're both kind of turned out bad for you. And so you take kind of their bad things and make a character that's pretty evil. But do you do that on purpose to have some sort of retribution, do you think? Do you kill them off?
I'm not going to comment on the killing off because there would be spoilers for all of my books.
Right.
I do it, I think, a little bit. It is therapy. It is therapy to kind of exercise your demons. I know in my first novel, Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent, it involves an assault. It involves an abusive situation, a woman being in an abusive relationship. So to me, that helped me get over my past abusive relationship in writing it. And even though, again, it was a horror novel, so it doesn't end well for anybody usually.
Yeah. But, it's not the happily ever after.
I know. It's it's funny. When my advanced reader copies went out for From Daylight to Madness, and I was getting some early reviews, people were saying, "Oh, my main characters, Isabel and Francis, I really hope it works out for them. Like, I hope they get their happily ever after." And I felt so bad because it's not a romance. So,
yeah,
you know, and some things, you know, they tend to not go as smoothly when you're both patients in a Victorian mental institution. Like, there's not a lot of chance for a good, good riding off into the sunset together.
Not a lot of warmth there.
I know.
Well, so what made you go to horror? Like, what was it that triggered you into writing, you know, frightening stories?
I've always been a huge horror fan since I was a kid. I read my first Stephen King at the age of 10, and I haven't looked back since. So it's my go-to genre for everything, for movies, for TV. And I like all kinds of horror, like 80s slasher flicks to the weird Japanese moody new horror movies. I like it all. And as a writer, I think I want to write something that I would want to read. And my favorite types of books in the horror genre are gothic horror. I love slow burning, unsettling, creepy buildings. You know, like, I like the idea that you can walk into a room and though it seems nice, like, you can tell, like, there, it looks like there's like faces in the wall. Like, I just love that kind of horror, like a subtle unease, a pleasurable terror, if you will. And that's what I like to write.
So when you write a story, what's the most important element? Do you think it's the literature, or do you think it's the story, the character? What do you find?
I think for me, it's the character. It's the character's emotional journey. I think that's the most important part for me. And that's even when I'm reading, because I read a lot, the character. I don't even need to like the character, but I do need to believe that character is real. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. So when you, let's say, things that you're going through in life and even things in the world. So, for instance, this year, so, you know, you're finishing this book, you're writing this book, and when dark things happen in the world, so, you know, you've got riots and you've got protests and you've got COVID and you have all sorts of things going on around you, though you're writing an older book, of course, so it's not going to have that in it, but does that seep into the way you write? Does it become darker?
It does. I really think it does. There's, I wrote a lot of From Daylight to Madness in the very early stages of the quarantine when nobody knew what the heck was going to happen, when it was still freezing outside and it was dark early and we weren't leaving our house for months. And so I think some of that, like, isolation crept into my characters. It crept into their world. There's a kind of a frightening loneliness about it. And the other thing that I found was, with From Daylight to Madness, it takes place in 1873. So, you know, we're years after the Civil War, but there's still like this, like, ache in the country. Like the, and I mention it a few times in the book. And I think we're kind of going through that now, because it's like very rarely does the world or even the whole country experience something together. And it kind of scars the country. It scars our world. And I think there's a similar feeling, a similar, you know, existential angst that happens after any kind of major tragedy. And I was feeling that, and I'm still feeling that now because of everything that's happening here in 2020. And I think my characters were feeling that when I was writing about them. But their scar, their big earth-shattering emotional thing, was the war. But the pain is still the same. The fear is still the same of what if it gets bad again? It always does eventually, but
yeah. Well, there's always a setback. So when you do something like this, it must take a lot of research to fill in the time space, like to be 18 in the 1870s, you must have to go back and make sure that your characters speak the way they're supposed to, the way, you know.
Yeah, I tried not to have the language be so stilted that it would be unreadable, but it was a lot of research. Most of the book takes place on an island, so there were just like a lot of things. I did a lot of research on some specific islands that are off the coast of New England where I live to understand just like everything about it, everything like how far you could dig a hole on a rocky island, specifically a very specific island I'm thinking about. And the research of all the little things that takes up so much time, like, what were they using for lights? What were their shoes like?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
What is, you know, the weirdest things, like I was trying to describe chairs on a porch. And I would call them Adirondack chairs. And I'm like, oh, when were Adirondack chairs invented? They weren't invented in 1873. You know, so like the little things like that, they add up. Like, oh, no, I wanted people to go into like a restaurant. But the word restaurant wasn't popularly used in the United States until the 1930s.
Right.
So I'm like, oh gosh, what do I call this random place of eating then?
You mean there was no McDonald's drive-through? No, but that's important. But because a lot of times when I read or if I'm watching a story about something happening a long time ago, like in the 1800s, it really throws me when their speech is so 2020.
Right.
You know,
I
like,
mean,
sorry for your loss. And it's like, what?
No,
you know,
I don't say that.
Yeah. Just,
yeah.
But that will throw my mind off of the story. So it's very important, I think, people really do the research.
Yeah, you have to. You have to. You know, my books take place in like this little island off the coast of Portland, Maine. And just like figuring out who was living there at that time, like what was the demographic of people? Who was staffing hotels, quote unquote, hotels that were really just places for a rest cure? Like who was working there? And, you know, so I did a lot of work. I had a genealogist help me, and she did great, outstanding research on old Victorian era island hotels of New England and what the staff was like. And it was the majority of people that worked there were young Irish girls. Mm. So, and I never would have known that. I did research on like an almshouse, a poorhouse, to figure out, you know, who was there, what was killing people, why were there orphans? Okay. And, you know, there was a Spanish influenza outbreak. So, because you just have to, like, figure out where your character is now and, like, and then backtrack it. Like, okay, she's 36 now, so that means when she was a child, this is what was going on. So every time she would have a memory of her childhood, I had to know about that time period, too.
Yeah. No, but that makes the story. That makes it complete.
It makes it authentic, you know, like you said, I love historical fiction, but I have a hard time watching a lot of historical fiction TV shows because they are so bad.
Yeah.
With, like, specifically the clothing sometimes. I'm like, What is she? She's wearing a prom dress. She wouldn't have bare shoulders.
Yeah. No, I know. I think because of the way things are streamed now, I think a lot of these streaming networks are under pressure to do a lot of shows. So I think there's a lot of formulated writing.
Yeah.
So people just kind of formulate it, put it together, and get it out there. And they don't pay attention to the detail. You know,
yeah.
And that throws people if they have any idea of what it was really like.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. So now, besides the story and the characters, so I pick up From Daylight to Madness and I bring it home and I read it. Is there something you want me to take away from that book other than the story and the characters?
Like,
is there a message underlying? Is there a theme? Is there something that you want to get across to people, even about your characters, but in a way of it represents to a group of people or something else, a certain statement?
I think, and this might sound like strange because it is a horror novel. I would want people to take away from my book that there are moments in your life that are so beautiful and so fleeting, but you can't forget them and you can't let the rest of the terror around you make those fade away. And you should try whatever you do to hold on to the glimmering, brief moments of happiness as much as you can. Really.
Yeah, it's true. It goes fast, you know.
It goes fast, you know. And especially when you're writing, like, darker fiction, like horror or even, like, thrillers, psychological suspense, time moves fast. And terrible things happen to me, you know, we put our characters through hell. And I do feel bad for doing that, but they have had some happiness. There are moments.
Yeah, right. You're a torturer. Yeah.
I do. I mean, you know, sometimes I really feel bad. I'm like, oh gosh, these poor people. Oh well.
Max. No, are you personal then with your characters? Like some of the fiction writers I've talked to have described their characters as their children or, you know, they're very important to them. And do you find that yourself?
Yes. Yeah. You know, so my first novel, Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent, my main character, his name's Adam, and I keep telling people, I'm like, I'm still not over him. He broke my heart. Writing him broke my heart. And like, part of me loved him. You know, even my fiance is like, oh, I think you're in love with your character. Like, I think I am too. I think as a writer, that means I'm doing a good job. If there's a character that I don't care about at all, then I'm not doing my job as a writer. Because if I don't love my characters, even love to hate them, I can't expect anybody else to. And Isabel and Francis from Daylight to Madness, there were scenes that I wrote for both of them that I felt it in my heart so much that like tears were streaming down my face. Like I felt all of their emotions. So I don't really think of them as my children, but I do think of them as kind of part of me.
Yeah. That's kind of what I get. I've never done fiction, so I have no idea myself. I couldn't imagine.
Yeah, it is really weird. It is, you know, and especially, so I'm a pantser, I'm not a plotter, so I kind of know the beginning, middle, and end of my books going in, but I don't really know how I'm going to get there. And sometimes they really do have like a life of their own. They do things, your characters, even though I'm typing it, and I'll scream at the computer, that was the wrong decision.
Oh.
Like, you did the wrong thing. You're going to ruin your whole life now. And then I just keep typing. I'm like, oh, yeah.
Wow. That's such a different experience than what I go through. So that's really fascinating, you know. Wow. Now, what does Jennifer do when she's got a block, when it's just not coming together? You're having a struggle. You can't get the story out. Is there something you do or go to try and break that?
Bourbon. No, alcohol. I haven't really had writer's block. I've had things where I feel like it's like not flowing, and if it's not flowing, I give myself permission to walk away from it for a couple days, a day. I'll do either research, or I do a lot of I make a lot of like promotional images for my books and stuff. So I'll look through photos, stock photos, and, you know, trying to find things that fit the feeling of my book. And sometimes that, like, I'll just see an image and go, oh, I'm unblocked. I feel it now. Like scrolling through hundreds and hundreds of photos, and then you see somebody that is exactly who your character is. And you go, oh, that's incredible. And just like the way they're standing or the way their eyes are moving. And then it invigorates me all over again.
So being a horror fan and being a horror author, how do you find modern day horrors compared to something, let's say, 100 years ago, or even in the 30s and 40s, like the Frankenstein, Dracula, and all that stuff, the originals like that, compared to what comes out now? Of course, nowadays, there's in movies, they've got so much better technique and more money and all that stuff, right? But the stories themselves, do you find modern-day horror stories to be as original or as good, or how would you describe them?
You know, I think there's a trend, a good trend right now that, like, it doesn't have a name, but I always call it smart horror. Like, the new Haunting of Hill House series from Netflix, movies like The Little Stranger, TV shows like Dark, or movies like Hereditary, things like that, that are taking horror to a new level, making it more emotional, more real. And again, I think you're getting really great actors now who are willing to star in horror films. Whereas even back in the 80s and the 70s, the horror films were like, you know, B-list, wow, no-name actors. Like, they would just, you know, hire nobodies, pay them $5,000. They, you know, get chased around the summer camp by somebody with an axe, and the end. I like those movies, but I think there's a more intellectualized horror now. Like, and I think that the thing that you brought up earlier about like all these streaming services, and we have access to everything now. We can watch all the old horror movies. Like, we're like desensitized in many ways to horror. And I mean, because the world is horrifying. So I think the things that are happening now in horror films, instead of just like making us scared and our hearts pounding, they're also making us think, and weirdly like worry and care. So I like what's happening in horror now. It's happening in horror novels as well. And I think there's a lot more female horror writers that are in the genre right now and that are getting some good attention.
But what does that bring? Like, what, so How do you distinguish between a female and a male, as in horror? This isn't my category. So is there a different type of writing that comes from a female, or let's say a feminine person, as compared to a masculine?
I don't think the writing is different. I think the respect is different now. And I think, I've been going to like horror conventions for years, and it's a very male dominated genre,
right?
For the people who were at the convention, to, you know, the actors they chose to be there, it was predominantly men. And I think my whole life, every time somebody says like, oh, well, what are you into? Like, what kind of movies, blah, blah, blah. And I always say, I'm into horror. And they're always shocked, like, not so much anymore, but they used to be like, oh, but that's like for guys, or that's, you know, or you seem so like happy and friendly. And I'm like, you think that just because I love horror and I'm obsessed with true crime podcasts and that I should be like, you know, mean?
Well, that's when you tell them you got two bodies in the trunk, so.
Yeah.
And there's room for a third.
There's room for more.
Yeah, but, I find that interesting how you, when you bring that up. I just wondered if they had a, if you, do you think you take a different angle to how you write a story about a horror or some sort of haunting as compared to maybe a male?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously experiences that I've had being a woman that I bring to my stories, but well, I mean, that's to be said for a man too. Like, there's, you know, the male experience is something that, even though I tend to write about male lead characters. And I sort of prefer writing men.
Yeah.
But
when I say that, coming from even a true crime nonfiction way, I find there is a difference with female writers. Like Anne Rule would attack a murder much different than Truman Capote, let's say.
Right.
You know, there's a different, they focus on different things. And that might not just, in the old times, it was probably male-female because of the roles we played. Nowadays, our roles are more equal and more the same, so maybe there's less difference.
Yeah, I think so. Because, to me, I don't really notice. I only notice it's like a male perspective, quote-unquote, or a female perspective. We'll say a male perspective. I only notice it when it's something where, like, they're just describing a woman, right, and it's, like, so overtly sexual for no reason.
Yeah.
Like, for no reason at all. It's like, you know, like, Barbara was making coffee in the office, her breasts tight, blah, blah, you know, like, all this stuff. And I'm like, why?
Yeah.
What? Yeah. Why is this even happening?
Right. And I think that's sort of what I mean. So in a horror, you're always, you know, like a lot of the old style horrors, you know, there was a lot of females that were the focus of the ones being terrified and killed or, you know, attacked. It wasn't, you weren't getting psycho with a man in the shower, right?
Exactly.
That, you know, so I just wondered that, because in true crime, it's changed. The attacks are much the same nowadays, but years ago, it was very distinct. You could tell the difference.
Do you think, in true crime, like, were the female authors, do you think I don't want to say favored the victims more, but I always felt like there was more of a focus on the victims.
Well, not so much that there was more, but they had more emotional ties.
Yeah.
So a female writer like Anne Rule could talk about how it was, what it was like to be loved by a killer or being beside someone and talk about it in a emotional, sensual way. Whereas a man in general, especially in the old days for sure, didn't write it that way. Do you know? You know what I'm saying? They wouldn't explain it as if, you know, to them it would be a different thing. When they, if they were sleeping with a serial killer and found out, they would talk about it in a different light. It's not so emotional or sensual.
Right.
It, and you're right. It would be more sexual and more
aggressive.
Yeah, more aggressive. So, you know, so there was a difference. I think nowadays I don't find as much of that. I think that it's more kind of across the lines now. I don't see so much of that. But so I was just wondering, because even, like I said, you look at the old horrors, even, you know, the Vincent Price and all those, and even Psycho, it was always aimed at a female, and it was written from a male perspective. So it was terrifying that way. But, you know, so what I'm saying is, do you think a female writer who wrote, if they were to write something like Psycho, would it come out the same?
Yeah, you know...
You know,
You know, it's really interesting because so like I'm like racking my brain, and because you're like traditional quote unquote traditional horror, it was always a woman running through the woods screaming, a woman you know fleeing a house, and in the two books that I have out so far, in everything I've written right now, the like in my first book, Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent, it's a story of a man being haunted and petrified. And the person doing the haunting is a woman. She's like this. So it's a female ghost and a petrified man. And
but that's more acceptable now. You can do that now, and people, it's more believable, it's more acceptable. If you did that in 1960, people would kind of think, oh, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. You know what I mean? They would. Yeah.
Men aren't like that. What are you talking about? You know, it's an awkward situation. I just think that it's good. I think that's a better thing because now people have more expression, you know.
Yeah. I know. I've had a lot of people, since I've been doing interviews and stuff, they've like come right out and asked me, they're like, is it hard to write from the point of view of a man? And I'm like, you would never ask a male author, oh, is it hard to write a woman?
Yeah.
No, you don't ask that. And I was like, no, because my characters are just having human experiences.
Right.
I haven't written anything from a man's point of view that I don't understand because I'm writing about human experiences. I'm writing about emotion.
Well, there's a correctness now going on, right? You know, as usual. But, you know, with the thing about even, you know, can a straight actor play a gay character? And can a, you know, there's all that stuff going on. And I think that it's kind of a little out of hand. I think that that's why you are an actor. You are acting.
Yes, exactly. You know,
you're doing that job. It doesn't matter. And the more we try to define our characters by their sexuality or by their color or whatever, it you kind of lose some of the humanity in it.
Right.
You know.
And, you know, and so in From Daylight to Madness, my character Isabel, so this is not really a spoiler, but somebody asks her, and she's married to a man. They ask her if she's ever really been in love. And she says, yes, I was in love with a girl. Her name was Molly. And I had somebody read it and they're like, oh my gosh, you're writing like an LGBTQ horror novel. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm just writing a horror novel. And they're like, oh, but she's pansexual or bisexual. And I'm like, yes, probably, but in her heart, she didn't even, there was no words for that for her. Like, she wasn't having a gay experience. It was an experience of love. Right. So.
And back then, you wouldn't, you know, in 1700s, any of those days, you wouldn't sit there and if you had an attraction, you wouldn't be thinking, oh, maybe we could get together and live together, buy a horse and two dogs. And that's
exactly.
Just, there was no such thing as developing a relationship, you know. It totally wouldn't be on their mind. Yeah.
Yeah. Like she didn't. And like, so when I was like exploring this with her character, it's like at that moment that she says Molly's name, I think truthfully, that's the first time she even admitted it to herself. Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I was in love once.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. But that's great. I think that that brings up an experience of someone a long time ago and how they would have felt about such feelings.
Right.
As compared to now. Because now, if you were writing a character in 2020, she would probably be open to the idea.
Yes. But, you know. Yeah, because, so like the whole thing in From Daylight to Madness, it's like one very brief scene, and it's a memory she has of, like, you know, Molly, her the girl she was in love with, kissing her very briefly while Isabel was sleeping. Or, but Isabel wasn't asleep, but she was too scared to open her eyes. And that was like the big thing. She was just like, what would have happened if I had opened my eyes and allowed myself to love this person? But it was like not even an option for her. She didn't even understand that she could do that.
Right. There was no concept of developing a relationship, moving in together, getting married, or any of that stuff. We'll adopt children. Yeah.
I know. It's especially, I mean, they just couldn't do it.
You don't know, it's not a focus, but it was still against the law. It was illegal. So, I mean, it was more attention on the male-male relationships, but but it was definitely not, legal. So, yeah, I think it's all interesting. I think it's great, and you're doing great work. Now, do you have a place that you would like people to come find your work? Do you have a website? Do you have, like, a blog or what?
I do. I have my website is jenniferanngordon.com, and that's Anne with an E, like Anne of Green Gables. So jenniferanngordon.com. That has kind of everything on there. It has my books. It has, I dabble in art and photography. So that's on there too. A link to my podcast, Fox Vomitists, is there as well. So that's kind of the be all end all, jenniferanngordon.com. You can get all my Instagram links and my Facebook links and everything are there.
Fantastic.
As well. And,
We'll put that on our website, and we'll put your book up there so people can click when they listen, and then they can find you, and they can, say hi.
I like it when people say hi. you can benevolently stalk me. Yeah, just don't really stalk me.
Yeah, don't be outside the door. You know.
Right. Yeah. I've seen too many true crime documentaries. I'm always watching.
Yeah. No, it's way too close to home. I'll tell you. Wow. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you so much, Alan. This was fun.
The book is called From Daylight to Madness, Hotel Number One. And our guest has been the author, which is Jennifer Ann Gordon. And I appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.